Greetings, every soul. This is Christopher Rudy with Cosmic Love, November 17th, 2012. Today, I'll be interviewing William Brett Stillings. Brett was raised in the intel community at an early age, served as a lieutenant in the United States Navy, and is a Congressional Medal winner in space exploration. He's one of the pioneers in advanced quantum space programs, has teleported to Mars, and has time traveled, believe it or not. And those who received my email announcing the show got some more information on this. And those who didn't get the email, I thought I'd share some of this. Brett received the Congressional Medal in Space Exploration, along with his team members that carry the same honor. Regina E. Dugan, former head of DARPA, is now with Google. Major Ed Dames, the world-renowned remote viewer. Barry Sotoro, also known as Barack Obama, and we'll go into that. William C. McCool, famed Columbia Shuttle astronaut. Andrew D. Basiago, fellow whistleblower team member to the Mars Colonization Program. Bernie Mendez, service to President Nixon. Thomas J. Stillings, Lockheed Skunk Works and CIA affiliate, who's Brett's father. And controller and trainer Raymond F. Basiago, who's the father to Andrew D. Basiago. William goes by Brett, is the person that discreetly wrote about the Fukushima disaster 4 years before it happened in 2011. We'll be discussing that. I provided a link on that. You can actually see his blog back years before that happened, where we reported that. And when he was forwarded 4 years in the future, he noted reading about the event 2 weeks after it occurred at a Starbucks in Temecula, California. He's also the individual who recorded the famous teleporter video at Area 51 to Alice Springs, Australia. And I provided a video link on that in the newsletter. And those who aren't on my email list, if you want that information, I can send it to you. So back about a year ago on Cosmic Love, I interviewed Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, who's the granddaughter of Ike, and she also discussed the time-space jump program that Brett has participated in. So I'm really glad to have you on the show today. Brett, thank you for coming on Cosmic Love.
It's an honor to be on the show. It truly is. It's a beautiful Saturday. We have a little bit of rain here in California.
Yeah. Well, we've had actually a pretty clear day here in Montana. It's been beautiful. And I'm really fascinated with your work. I've been following different reports of it, Project Camelot and other sources over the years. And I'm really would like a bit more of a history. If you could give us your story and how you got into this program, how it proceeded, and some of the highlights.
Well, in all honesty, I was in the program before I knew I was in the program. I was, I remember about age four, age five. A question asking, what things do you like? And it basically came around to science, and I was very much science oriented, and apparently, before I even caught on, and still I didn't, I never attributed a lot of my growing up as training until quite a bit after. My father worked at JPL, worked at Bendix, and went on to Lockheed Skunk Works when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I was actually being prepped around age 10. But leading up to age 10, I was familiarized with a lot of alien equipment. Those have been termed as flash guns, and they are called flash guns. And other, devices like that, which really Tesla is best known for producing such technology, and that comes up later on as what the technology, what the whole industry was based on, was basically Tesla technology. But about age 12, I was being trained. Before I knew it, we were going up to hiking up to Mount White, which is about 14,700 altitude, 700 foot altitude. And I had already made, I made affirmations around that time that I am a part, that I want to do this exercise. I want to do this whole thing that we were doing. That we need to go in this direction, and made affirmations as to what we need to get out of life, what we need to produce, what needs to be done. You know, what kind of threw me on my ear, I guess, looking back, was that before I knew it, you know, having done teleportation in 79, and just couldn't imagine that there was anything bigger than that. I think that was one of the you know, teleporting 78 and 79, as brief as it was, you know, quarter second trips, you know, going about 700-800 miles, you know, out of Sylmar, out of the San Fernando Valley. You know, it just, you know, It just puts you in that whole thought process to where you pretty much know what you want to do in life. Honestly, I mean, that was a
What more is it kind of expands your horizons like nothing else.
Yeah, it was a big crescendo. I mean, that was really you know, ninth grade. That was
wow.
That was up to that point the biggest thing that you could possibly think.
Yeah.
I remember science questions and stuff, you know, that were very much along that line. I think that was the quietest time I ever got in my life.
Well, did you go to special schools or? I mean, in the programs, were there like special schools, or was that kind of like extracurricular, like camps that you went to?
There was get-togethers and stuff, but everything was done on a county state level. I mean, you know, we weren't made of money.
Yeah,
I'm sure that there were schools for those that were doing things that needed exclusive, isolated training.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't, you know, so much a part of that. In fact, I was very flexible, and that was one of the attributes that I actually carried. You got to remember, you know, we're on an engineer's budget growing up, and basically everything in industry we had to pay for, basically, and really did.
Uh-huh.
I mean, expenses was out of the people's pocket. We mean like us. It's industry, you know, as you know, the CIA had to consign out to, by selling cocaine or drugs.
Yeah.
And that was the major, that's primarily why they were flying plane loads of cocaine and selling them instead of teleporting, because basically whatever higher ups were saying that you couldn't teleport it. So they were still having to do that until they were finally kicked out of the United States. And went to Australia.
And then yeah, I remember that back at the time when Clinton was flying in the stuff at Mena, Arkansas, you know, and exchanging the guns for the cocaine. And of course, it's pretty well known now that was funding a lot of these projects that they couldn't get funding for otherwise. But you say you were living kind of a normal life, but having some extraordinary experiences. Hello? Hello?
Yeah, one moment. Interesting. I was connecting with Ben Bad. I'm happy enough. I'll have to reconnect with him. His connection is
okay.
Bad.
We've got those who are listening. We've got Skype connection, and we're going to see how this goes.
Hello, sir?
Yeah.
Oh,
got you back? Good.
Yeah, I don't know what happened, but as soon as I got the CIA and cocaine, it went bad.
Yeah, that happens. Well,
let's try Skype.
Let's try her again. I'm really interested in what that was back. You were about 14 back then, so that was back about when 1970.
Yeah, I mean, really, 85, 87 was when. Agency got in trouble, had to consign out to another country. They're basically told that they couldn't be doing what they were doing inside of the United States. So, agency was still kept in place for looks or for the public, but CIA was really kicked out of the United States. Honestly,
yeah. So
everything they were doing out of Australia.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we won't go into that. But you know, I'm really fascinated with your time travel experiences too, and the Fukushima incident. How much did you do the time travel stuff as compared to the teleporting, like to the Mars colony?
TTN didn't really occur as much, and wasn't really prepped. I'll say this, and we haven't disclosed nearly anything yet until about year 2000 after 21st century.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, there were some things, but it didn't get really extensive, and we don't really cover anything past 2001, honestly. You know, the Fukushima thing is just a rarity because it was such an immediate importance of getting a response back then. Of you know, back in 2007, I was really searching for answers, and I was getting really upset. You know, I had family members that had very, very much very personal health problems, and was getting certain things to certain things were happening at certain times that were culminating to playing factors into what I understood as to what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And one of the acts of desperation was coordinating it, getting it, where I could forward it and find out what the hell was going on. You know, being that everybody else was getting a look ahead, it was only fair for me to have a look ahead too. And so, you know, we went ahead and did that. But basically, when I was forwarded, we did it locally to in Temecula. That was in Temecula, California.
Uh-huh.
And where I was basically at. And it was you know, I've said before, is anywhere on Earth you're not going to teleport over 1.25 seconds. If you had, then you're either waveguided in position, you know, until a receiving unit was available, you know, bounced around, or you're basically teleported to a platform above the Earth, you know, a couple 100,000 miles away. You know, time is indistinguishable from distance, and so time is distance. But anywhere on Earth, you're not going to, you know, most of the teleportation up until about 81, what wasn't over 3/4 of a second, you know, out of Silmar to the desert was a quarter second, about quarter to a half second. Australia was surprisingly about 3/4 of a second. And, you know, there's a cause and effect of delay in a couple of different ways. But it basically equates out to, you know, about 1.25 seconds on Earth. You know, my first trip to Mars was 18 minutes in 1981. That was around September 1981. Took 18 minutes to get there.
Took how many seconds?
It took 18 minutes to get there.
18 minutes.
Yeah. And when you got in the teleporter, basically 1981, during that month, it was only one person was allowed in the teleporter. Period. You know, there what they, you know, you could only cram so much air in the space to take with you.
Uh-huh.
And that was imperative. I mean, you know, if in 1981, 18 minutes, you could push two people through, you know, for the size of it. It, you know, only if those people had gone before, you know, or one person was there that had gone before.
Uh-huh.
And basically, you know, a couple months, you know, 6 months later or so, Mars would be a lot closer or whatever, but, or maybe even further depending, but, that was 18 minute trip in 1982. I think February 1982 was a little bit less than a 15 minute trip and a 10 minute trip and an 8 minute trip. In between that 10 and 8 minute trip, Mars had come and gone and was actually 4 minutes from Earth. You know, but 1984 was my year where it was a big party session where, you know, 4 or 5 people could be in the teleporter at once. And that was the next biggest thing, to slice bread for me.
Yeah,
and you know, kids. Some people would bring up lighters and stuff. You know, in '84, you know, you'd push the rules a little bit or the guidelines, and some kids would bring lighters and stuff. You know,
was it mostly kids in the program, or is it why was it that they used mostly young people?
Young kids are you know, kids can be more malleable to not say anything, to not talk about what, you know, the exercises and everything and all the training and everything. And,
uh-huh.
You know, I wouldn't say a word, you know, somebody would say something and I'd give them kind of a fishy look until I could check them out later and, you know, ask Dad, is this person all right? Can I talk to this person? You know, you don't know his father. Is his father industry? What, you know, is his father part of what we're doing? And until I, you know, could find out, you know, next day or maybe a week later, you know, the person would come up, they would seem, one person actually came up starting to sound, be a little offended. And I said, yeah, you know, I answered their question about teleporting everywhere. And he like looked at me. And I didn't say it, but I think he basically understood that I wasn't sure if it was all right to
talk.
And
about that.
And in fact, I got one of those. No, it's all right. You know, I'm doing a lot of things. Blah 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 blah. I'm like, all right. And you know, you just didn't know until you had them checked out. And in fact, there was an instance in school where the person was in industry. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He didn't, you know, realize where he was treading. And he was going on rumor, which means that somebody else was talking that wasn't me. And, you know, so I never talked to some of the kids at school. I just never talked to them. They weren't part of what we were doing. They'd heard through something that what was going on or just something, but that was about it.
Well, are you a lieutenant in the Navy now and still doing this stuff?
I made lieutenant. And this is me and Andrew Bishago, Regina Dugan, William McCool, Courtney Hunt, Tom Stellings, Raymond F. Bishago, Ed Dames, Barry Satoro, current acting president of the United States, which he is not qualified to be. He never announced anybody of a name change.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was certainly Barry Satoro in 1981, 1982.
Well, what did they do? Did they see him in the time programs? I mean, going, you know, see him as president in the future, and then just kind of groomed him for the program.
Yeah, yeah. The agency just basically went automated and stupid at that point. And just because they saw it, man, no. There might be a contingency that you might not want him to be president. You know, somebody who sells out, or somebody who takes the easy way out, tanks everything, destroys everything so they don't have to put any effort in or work. No, that's not the way to do things.
So once they saw that he was going to be president, they just really prepped him for the role.
Yes, basically, yes.
I mean, it just makes sense that that's what they would do. I mean, and that's the big question I have. When they – different things that they saw happening in the future, and I understand that they could only see to a certain point, which is really coming up to a wall here on December 21st. That's about as far as you could see with your programs, wasn't it?
Yeah. In fact, I was not formally good with remote viewing. In fact, to the point that it took me took about year 2005 to realize that I passed 2011, as I wrote about in one of the blogs back in 2008, and was kind of people were asking me advice, and I couldn't really see past that somebody had brought my attention to it, that I couldn't really see past 2011. And I was like, I was really coming to terms with that. And that was, that was understandable with everything on the sine wave, or the three-dimensional sine wave, and the time compression. And it's more than understandable. I mean, when you teleport, you're very isolated. When you get to Mars, when you teleport to Mars, you're disconnected from the consciousness of Earth. And there is a consciousness, and there is noise. It is actually it's very quiet, and spiritually quiet, I guess I'll call it, to where you literally know what the other person is thinking with very, very intense clarity. I mean, more so than here.
Huh.
It's just there's a very abrupt, noticeable difference. Planet Mars isn't NASA's 8 millibar, it's 800 millibar or so. And, it is the equivalent of about 12,000 foot altitude with a 14,000 foot altitude oxygen level, with a little bit more CO2 than Earth. Nothing than what they say, 0.9, that high. I mean, it's not, NASA's just something.
Can you talk about what you were doing on Mars?
Yeah, one of the very key things that we were trained to do was to stay as long as we possibly could until we were seen by our air captain for like a head count, to participate in colonizing, which is why our status wasn't given to us. When you teleported to Mars, you qualified. When you came back, you were a lieutenant. You qualified as a lieutenant in the United States Navy.
Uh-huh.
That is our rank, and our rank is validatable with the Department of Defense, and also in Virginia Navy Yard.
So is that program still going on, or?
That's a good question. There was a colonization. We had to colonize as civilians. We could not do it as military officials, and we were not doing it as military officials. My status was given to me at age 24, 25, and that is when my official standing as a lieutenant became official.
So the people that were doing the program before, they were military officers, they were civilians.
Correct. We could not, by the rules, we could not colonize as military personnel.
Now, are those the rules of the Galactic Federation, or whose rules are those?
those are the rules that were impressed back on us by the Greys, because those are our rules.
But did you say by there are rules?
Yeah. United States doesn't colonize as a military. It's done in the form of civilians going out and going to an unknown land or whatever and colonizing.
It's not done as a military. That's international law, isn't it?
Yeah. And Ray very much made that very apparent that we had to pay to our own rules, which you can only imagine makes things more expensive.
Interesting.
And I mean, people like, yeah, but you got to teleport. Yeah. And when I went to, when I teleported out to Alice Springs or out to Australia, and there's my father's warning again. You know, I had to stay on the compound. I had to have a passport just like anybody else to go off United States territory, to go out of the fenced area. To do so would be going to Australia, or would be in Australia, and you had to have a passport just like anybody else. And passports cost about $160 now, where they cost about $60 to $90 back then.
Well, I'm really interested with the time we are in now. And what is your understanding, and I've been getting this from a lot of different directions, that there's something really unique going on with the quantum field into December 21st.
It's a time
what's
compression.
Your impression of that?
It's a time compression. On the flip side, whenever you have a gravity generator or a 12-phase motor or a John Searle SEG, there are heights of energy or an energy buildup on one side or one part of that motor. And in reflection, just as that is perfectly there, or that 97, as an energy buildup is on that one section of the roller motor or on that generator, just as on the Earth, there's a galactic or, you know, in our galaxy is a motor generator and, you know, Earth even as a revolving mass qualifies. But it's more to it that the galaxy, our galaxy is a functioning gravity generator, which is why the center of our galaxy, our supermassive black hole, which is a functioning gravity generator, looks like the shape of a disc or a round vehicle.
Uh-huh.
Is because it is perfectly conducive for that shape. And that's why round vehicles are that shape.
An atomic level, it's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. An atom is an over-unity device. It is a motor generator.
Yeah.
And is an over-unity device. It is attached to a time domain for energy to mass. It has mass because it's attached to a time domain in our domain and we as, people say, is it a fixed universe or is it an observable universe? It is both. We make things real. We consciously, as an observable universe, make matter real. And it is also a fixed universe. So it's an interaction of both. And
something's going on with, as I understand, with what they call galactic alignment on December 21st is our solar system coming up into alignment with, in the 25,800-year precession of the equinox, it comes into alignment with, 250-some billion star systems right in towards the great central sun of our galaxy?
Correct. That's a dead spot on the motor. We're actually falling into a dead spot on the energy level on that motor, and that's basically a dead spot. So what was needed for any 12-phase motor or gravity generator, and I term it a 12-phase motor because for good reason, it was a great way to disinfo a conversation, really come across an electrician, and you can identify the electrician. And if they're an electrician, then you can talk to them in certain ways that they would understand, and it would help identify things. But basically with a gravity generator, as John Searle and the genius of John Searle has pointed out, you have to have at least 12 rollers or 12 of anything on the gravity generator. It cannot have less than 12, and 12, you know, and it goes to the tune, or a good example is the proton energy position level of geometrically stable elements,
uh-huh.
of like bismuth or Bob Lazar's element 115, or my element, element 147, mass 405, or element 179, 211, 243, 275, 307, all 32 protons increasing from bismuth, just go up 32 and then 32 again, 32 again. And as the proton energy position level for any, for a geometrically stable or conducive for a gravity element, like bismuth or element 115 would be like, the protons and the energy shells would be 2, 6, 12, 8, 22, 32, 1 for 83 for bismuth. And a gravity generator basically operates or has to, you know, basically would have 12, 22, 32, or 12, 20, 32, 44, or, you know, whatever stylized generator it is.
Uh-huh.
Typically, the big magic is actually having 32 electrons in the fourth shell, and that identify the elements can be used for such a device.
Well, I'm not going to attempt to translate all that for listeners, but I do get the sense that this alignment of our solar system, and its sine wave curve as it goes up and down across the galactic plane, you're saying that that at this unique time, and of course I understand this is why everything has been accelerating as far as technological innovation, the computer internet revolution, conscious evolution,
yes,
everything's been accelerating, and it's to this point of some people call it zero point or a mega point.
Yes.
I mean, they're just a different names for what you're saying, really. I understand it.
All those heights of the different types of waves, they all converge to a compression point where it's, you know, basically sine wave zero on that date, on that Mayan calendar.
Sine wave zero.
Yeah. It's all the magic in an atom or an over-unity device happens in the transition from sine wave zero into motion. So that point from zero to that distance that is not zero is where all the the magic or all the energy of the atom is stored and accessible and pronounced.
So what kind of magic do you think we're in for?
Guys have already experienced a lot of it, but
yeah.
A lot of it has been taken away. You guys were actually supposed to experience a lot more around vehicles and stuff, but like unavoidably.
we were all
supposed to experience it, and it's a very good thing. And, you know, it's a good development period. I mean, this is the time for people to develop it, to go forward. Because, I mean, it just, it starts again. You're on the height of the wave. The wave is passing, which the party session kind of declines, but it's a great developmental period for that period. I mean, this is the point where the evil tries to skirt through after ripping off society.
Uh-huh.
And there is an evil entity that is out there.
Yeah.
And there is. And there's also great entities out there that are absolutely, you know, that are key for development, and, you know, creation very much wants you to develop and to progress forward, and that is
so,
getting past the 2012 period.
So, in your remote viewing experiences with the others with the team, what did they see coming as far as Earth changes in the transition?
I wasn't so much the remote viewer. unless it was my father asking or Ed Dames, or other people, mostly females in agency, I wouldn't lock up if I had more of a tendency to speak freely or to not convolute my own thoughts if asked by you know, people in agency. And these are difficult questions. You know, the timeline do change, and you know, even now, of course, affecting that time, but because actually, it's too late to be able to affect it. They would have to affect it, and that would be them doing it. So,
so there's two timelines, I understand. Well, there's some people out there saying that there are actually two timelines. There's the positive timeline and the negative timeline. And I've heard that it's not foreordained or etched in stone. You know, mankind has free will and anything is possible. What's your take on that?
There's quite a few timelines. Washington, D.C. is coming up to being underwater in April. Is supposed to be. It's in best interest if, you know, geographically, there was going to be far more cataclysms that were supposed to occur. In fact, the great L.A. earthquake was supposed to occur.
And it didn't happen.
In 2010, yeah, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And that was, and I'll tell you, that was shown to me in a very perfect resolution visual way. And that was actually to occur. That was a very big abrupt thing, which kicked people in the play to be aware of that cataclysms are very hard to avert during this period in time. That there's a lot of downtime, and you know, and that you know, a lot of preventative maintenance have been put into place to where certain cataclysms wouldn't occur. And I'm surprised that the 2010 didn't occur. But from what I remember, it was also kind of being conveyed that things had changed for the better, or things had changed in a different way. Some things were good outcomes, a lot of things weren't. But
I can just barely hear you. I don't know if it's a bad connection or...
Hello? Is that better? Is that
better? Yeah.
All right. Yeah. It's there was just a lot of the whole timeline thing is just so much to go into. It's just
so it's more or less amorphous is what you're saying, that there's other factors that are influencing the timeline that are kind of nonlinear.
Yeah, a lot of things are. You know, a lot of my thinking has very much always been a lot of nonlinear things. In fact, I don't, you know, in reflection to how we are as people, we don't learn things directly. We learn things indirectly, and very much my developmental skills and everything that I've been doing has been very much nonlinear, and I've learned just to do so like that. And it might reflect in my bouncing around quite a bit, but There's so much. I mean, with doing the Mars program, with the colonization program, Mars being the 51st state of the United States that people don't even realize or even know about, really, which it is. And I mean, it truly, really is.
Are there a lot of people up there now, or is it just kind of they come and go?
A lot of people have been implying to me in the last 8 months that some goofy things are going on. And I will tell people, you know, I still maintain and tell people that Mars is inhabited, as Andrew Bishago has stated. Uh-huh. It has predatorial life, and I personally attest to that.
Really?
There is atmosphere on Mars. Oh yeah, when you get out of the jump room, the very, very, very first thing that you do is unless you're going to pass out, the very first thing you do is get outside to see what the hell's around you. and to make sure that you know what's around you and make sure that you can run back inside to safety if you have to.
What kind of predators do they have?
Well, there's just unbelievably tall things there, dinosaur-looking things. There's reptilians that like to play games, too.
Seriously?
That came later, and that was one of my biggest fears. From what I understood, is a lot of people that were visiting Mars had ended up disappearing because they were not only being counted by a reptilian, but I believe also eaten or taken back someplace.
Yeah.
But
there's dark side stuff all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the first people I was counted by was a 7-foot reptilian.
Yeah.
And that was in front of Andrew Bishago and Courtney Hunt. And that was actually at the big jump room structure. People want to look up the jump room structures on Google Mars.
Uh-huh.
They can do so by typing in Viking 2 lander, Viking 2, and going off at 135 degrees, 9 and 10 miles to that plateau. Those two rectangular-looking things when you zoom in are those two dots that stand out on the plateau are about 30 to 40 foot tall rectangular concrete structures. The furthest jump room structure is a smaller one. That's exactly 7.2 miles out from Viking 2 lander, as the crow flies, it's exactly 10 miles. You know, you look at terrain, I did one of my classic blank
out. Flashback?
Well, I just kind of drew a blank.
That jump room stuff to Mars, and hello, you there?
Yes, right here.
That experience, what you're talking about, to me, it's really intriguing, you know, that the coordinates, you know, how you can actually go and that, how they can do the coordinates, the time-space coordinates, and get it so exact for that
distance.
Well,
it's not required to. Because of the Apollo program and the heroes in the Apollo program, they were the ones that facilitated a receiver unit to be established on Mars.
Oh.
When I was in the Mars program, I was not teleporting without a receiver unit on the end. What you are talking about is very real. Quantum entanglement retains the same spin angle no matter the distance traversed. Andrew Bishago very much did teleport to certain places without a receiver unit on the other end. And that is very, very gutsy, ballsy.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope he had his zapper with him just in case the reptoids were there.
Oh, I mean, just getting there, there could be accidents. I mean, if teleporting on Earth for 2,000 miles, the radius, the circumference, I'm sorry, you know, spin angle will remain the same. So, I mean, literally, you would have to have a operator to, you know, do a three halves and then half spin flip just to be able to have the person standing upright when they got to their destination.
Yeah.
And you got to remember that things move in the act of teleporting. So compensating for delay and getting it narrowed down to even a couple hundred feet is pretty talented, especially back in the 70s. I mean, really.
Well, you could also get teleported and be, what, 10, 15 feet over the ground?
Or under.
Has that ever happened?
That actually happened to a kid that Andrew Bishago is with. They were teleporting out to the desert, and one of the locations was near a building, and the kids were getting scattered all over the field. One of the kids actually landed in a very large fountain, but that only had like a couple inches of water in it. It was an empty fountain, but it still had like rainwater or some water in the bottom. And hydrogen being an oscillator, being an odd numbered element, the hydrogen slowed the effect of the teleportation, so his feet were technically the last things to arrive. The kid slid off his feet, literally. His feet were still in his shoes, and he was not connected to his feet.
Yeah.
Yes, accidents do happen. When we were trained to run into the device or into the wall, the field, teleporting, your body is to exceed faster than 1 meter per second. By law, you had to. If you threw your hands back in the act of jogging or running like we naturally do when we jog, if that total sum is less than 1 meter per second, your hands would not be with you on the end of the trip. There were dangers. There was not game plan dangers that were very much rules that you had to follow when teleporting. These were very important.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you were really pioneering the new frontier of teleportation.
Yeah, there were those before me. But yeah, I got a really heavy duty, quite a bit of things after, and I mean quite a bit of things. The Fukushima thing, there is so much more that we haven't presented forward with, that is, far and above that.
Well, I was going to ask, what do you do with information like that when you can see something in the future, like Fukushima, you saw that 4 years in advance.
I didn't see to clarify, I didn't see the event at all.
You saw the newspaper.
Yeah, I read the paper, and this was it. You know, when I did that, it went from sunny to a slightly drizzly day, clouded over, colder. And as soon as I felt the field, I just instinctually started running, and I got that little voice in my head that said that I didn't have to run, and I kept running anyways until I didn't feel it as much, and you know, ran a good 80-100 feet, and I mean, just instinctually did so because I felt the field, and. That was a, you know, I knew from about 10-15 minutes prior that today was the day that I was going to teleport, and I saw some indications that I'm not going to elaborate on, but when I went forward, and when I got there. The paper's date, I believe, was either was about 2 to 3 weeks. The paper was discussing it as if it had already happened for about 2 to 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And
you got the coordinates. You got the coordinates on the earthquake right out of the newspaper.
I got a lot of indication. Yeah, the location for it, and. You know, and basically I didn't have a, you know, I was going online at the at a library, basically, you know, using the internet from there.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I just very subtly wrote about and waited for an answer for somebody, you know, somebody from agency to contact me, and you know, and get some answers as to what the hell was going on. You know, for the question,
what do you do with information like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the answer. That I mean, I was asked, you know, I asked to be shown what the hell. Was I doing all this work for over 10-15 years, you know, academically, which carried on to also what we were doing, you know, basically consigned to do, but didn't apparently finish, and was finished from our end, but
yeah. Well, there was other times than when you, like you said, that they some of the time jumpers or remote viewers saw this saw this thing in California in 2010, and then that didn't happen. So I guess you can't act on information until you know it's going to happen for sure.
Right, right. There are people that I've entrusted that are far more qualified and with information that it's always worked out, you know, well.
It yeah.
worked out good. I see what you're trying to say, but they're really, there's, two or three separate things, that those are just different from each other.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean, timelines and everything.
Well, I'm probably most intrigued. I'm getting it from so many different directions that the time we're in right now, it's almost like no one knows for sure. And I get all these different perspectives, over the last several years, and all these different people talking about 2000, something that's going to be going on into the end of 2012, with a huge shift.
Well, it's with people. In regards, people will change. People will change.
Yeah.
Things. All the knowledge and everything is pronounced very clearly. As you all know now, there's very few mysteries right now that people are just consciously aware.
That's what I was thinking. Everything is being they call it the great unveiling.
Yeah, and that it is. That is.
That's, and, I thought it was a good time to have you on the show. It was like perfect timing. It's like, well, this is part of the unveiling, folks.
Yeah. The summarize, NASA lies to you. The government has lied to you. They haven't presented a lot of the technology that they've been utilizing, for good reason. I mean, ask yourself, really, how did Satoru or Barack Obama nation get into office, and how did he get in office a second time?
It's no question to me how all that happened. The way that they can create a public illusion of what's real, that's not even true.
Not even close.
Electronic, not even close.
With Diebold, electronic ballot counting.
Yeah.
Do the people really think that their vote counted?
Yeah. I wrote a series of articles on that, and both – this is interesting. Both Obama and Romney had with Bain Capital had – they had their own – they had their own vote rigging operation going, but Obama had a better one.
yeah. It's all staged, though. I mean, Romney was only put in there just to give that one little liner that he conceded something to yeah. Satoru. Satoru's not qualified to be president in the first place. Romney was just a stooge to try and portray that was a fair election. The current acting president, the United States does not have a president right now.
Well, what's interesting
and it hasn't
to me
had
is
a president.
What's interesting to me is that he's a very good a teleprompter reader, and he's very well scripted.
Yeah, you can only really get training like that in industry. I mean,
that's
really,
right. That's right. And he's been trained for years, and people have no idea that's the case. And actually, to prevent what's called planned obsolescence, keep a status quo continuity of government thing going, where things don't change that much, and so that big oil, big pharma, big war, and big ownership and control can continue on. That seems to be the policy.
Yeah, it's not as cut and dry, and it's kind of like one without the other. But that was actually a very good stabilized way of doing things, you know, to get people stable and to be able to get on development.
Right.
You know, those bastards were going to be there anyway. So, I mean, you just minimize the big pharma and minimize the asshole oil companies. Can we say asshole?
Well, yeah, I suppose we can.
Sorry.
You know, I think there's a lot of, what it comes down to is that the future will have this free energy technology. It will have quantum healing, frequency healing that'll zap viruses and bacteria in the body. It'll have all these technologies that, of course, you know exist and I know exist and a lot of people know it exists.
Well, treat the body as a wave. Everything is a wave.
As a wave, that's right. And I've actually pioneered ultramolecular medicine with quantum biology with the Breakthrough System here in the early 90s, and I had to get out of it because... You know, it disrupts the status quo.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know how many phone calls did you get, or how much deterrence did you experience?
Well, it was just I had too many clients going back to a local doctor saying, you know, this is the future of medicine. And they hated that, you know, because you can't get a medical degree in quantum biology and ultramolecular medicine. And, we're coming to the end of our showtime. I can't thank you enough, Brett, for coming on the show. It's been really cool. And I'd love to do this again sometime.
That's Hello? Excellent. Yes.
Yeah, I'd love to. And I want to. Thank you so much for coming on, and for everyone listening. Guess I'm going to have to pretty much do a wrap here. I would like to time jump to the December first show on Cosmic Love. I'll be interviewing Mayan elder Don Miguel Ruiz. He's author of that international bestseller, The Four Agreements, and that's going to be an interesting show coming up, and. Brett, I would love to have you on again on a regular basis. I think your perspective is real interesting. I'd like to have you on here right after the first of the year to see how things have changed.
I hope I'm there. that would be great. I'd love to the show again.
Thanks so much for coming on. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Happy trails until the next time, December 1st, and... God bless you, everyone.